Good morning. You're listening to Prescriptions for Health on PRN.FM and DrSaputo.com on Monday, September 24th, 2012. I'm Dr. Len Saputo.
And I'm registered nurse Vicki Saputo. Thank you for joining us on Prescriptions for Health every Monday from 7 to 8 a.m. Pacific Time and 10 to 11 a.m. Eastern Time. And keep in mind that our shows are archived and available 24/7 on PRN.FM and DrSaputo.com.
Today we're going to be talking about what's new in the news and health, and you're going to hear Vicki's 2020 health tips at 20 after the hour and 20 to the hour. And we've got a fantastic show for you today that's going to include GMO crops must immediately be outlawed.
And can surgery bring on Alzheimer's disease?
And what kinds of jobs increase the risk for heart attacks?
Does the swine flu vaccine increase the risk for getting the swine flu? What about the seasonal flu vaccine? Can that increase the risk for getting the swine flu?
And what about this thing on breath? We've got baby's breath, we've got garlic breath, and now we've got cancer breath? That's going to be fascinating. We'll get to that towards the end of the show.
We have some shocking news about genetically engineered food, also so-called GE foods and GMO foods, also referred to as genetically modified organism foods, where the species are mixed and the genes are swapped, producing foods with unpredicted adverse effects. I mean, these are used in food crops to kill insects and weeds.
Yeah, amazing that we have all this. And what is it? How do we actually make these GMO foods? And basically what we do is we attach a gene to a virus. Then we inject the virus that carries it into the plant or into people or into mammals, whatever we want to. And it changes the DNA, the genetic makeup of the organism. So it now has a new property. And we talk about that in medicine. This is really valuable stuff. We're talking about gene therapy, which is good medicine. We can use it to make insulin for people who can't, or for making clotting factors for people who have hemophilia. It can make growth hormone for people who have stunted growth and different enzymes that we need. And it may cure eventually diseases like Parkinson's disease or cystic fibrosis, a lot of things like sickle cell or muscular dystrophy. So it's got some great potential. But when you look at its use in agriculture, it is a disaster.
Well, a former study shows that rats fed genetically modified corn with trace levels of Roundup develop malignant tumors 80% of the time. And 70% of the female rats die from mammary cancer, which in a human is breast cancer. And 50% of the males died from severe liver and kidney damage. These tumors, if you look at the pictures, they are horrifyingly huge.
Yeah, well, see, the problem here really is that we're doing only a limited amount of research that's being done by the companies that are making these products. That's Monsanto and DuPont and many others like that. And when we have limited research, then we have limited knowledge. And if we have limited knowledge, we don't know what the outcome is going to be. And when you look at short-term experiments, it doesn't seem to be a problem. But when they did these studies on rats, what they found out is that towards the end of the rat's life, they would come down with these awful illnesses that if we could have an epidemic of, that would be a disaster for us. So,
we have to really pay attention to these animal studies because, see, animals don't have as long of a lifespan as we do. And by the time those results would come about in a human, I mean,
it would be in
another generation or two.
See, we've only had these things in these GMO foods in our consumption for about the last 10 or 12 years. I think they came out in 1994. So we're looking at something that is brand new to us and relatively unexplored.
And also, you know, think about Roundup, the herbicide.
Sure.
Levels that are legally allowed in the water supply result in 200 to 300 increase in the large tumors. Wait a minute. I think Roundup is an insecticide.
Okay.
But anyway, it increased 200 to 300 increase in the large tumors. And so what they did was in the rat water, they even gave them less than what we would drink because they tried to make it be the same amount, you know.
Well, we're doing a global experiment here, Vicki, with a lot of different kinds of toxic things in the environment. You know, when we did the study on the body burden about 10 or 12 years ago, this was done by the Environmental Working Group, they came out with information that was shocking. And basically, they were looking for about close to 200 different kinds of pesticides and herbicides and different kinds of neurotoxins and things that cause birth defects and cancer. And they studied 9 people scattered throughout different parts of the country. And what they found in those 9 people, by checking the levels of these compounds, is they were all over the place. There wasn't anybody who had less than 80 of them. So when you put these all together, you get kind of a synergistic effect that's much bigger than when you just take one thing into your body or two things in your body. The classic example would be, what's the effect of DDT in causing breast cancer? And what's the effect of DDE, which is a compound similar to DDT, if they're used together? And it wouldn't be just 1 + 1 = 2. It's 1 + 1 = 4 times the risk. So when we start looking at the things that we're doing to plants and what it does to people, it's going to be something that's totally a mystery until we do the study.
Yeah, it's in our food, water, and air, and in our blood.
So when you look at companies like Monsanto, this is the same company that said DDT and Agent Orange are okay. Now there's GMOs, okay, what are you worrying about? In fact, they're totally dishonest about it. They're basically saying they don't want you to know that they're putting GMO foods out there for you to buy. They want it not to be labeled. They want to have it be something that you don't even know is happening, because now there's a proposition in California. It's called Prop 37 that is to try and get rid of GMO foods, or at least tell us if we're consuming GMO foods.
No, it has to do with the labeling.
Yes, with the labeling. So if you don't know that it's there, because they don't have to tell you, then all of a sudden you'll be consuming enormous amounts like we're starting to. I mean, there are lots of foods that we're consuming that are a real problem.
Well, it's really important for Californians to vote yes on Proposition 37 to require the labeling of these genetically engineered foods. And it will make a precedent for the rest of the United States, actually probably the rest of the world. I mean, it's really a great start. And if people want to know more, they can go for CaliforniaRightToKnow.org, and it's CARightToKnow.org. And genetically engineered companies have spent over $12 million already to try to encourage people to vote no on 37. You can't believe that stuff. You know, one of the things that they try to say, these big companies, is that we need it for the world food supply, and that's just really not true. And the crops seem to be failing, and so are the farmers, due to the insect-resistant rootworms from YieldGuard. And then the weeds are becoming resistant to the Roundup, and those are destroying the crops. And these are poisons that are destroying the soil and the nutrition, and in turn, our food.
Well, that's what's happening for sure. It's the same thing as what happens to the ecosystem in our intestinal tract.
Yeah, we're getting resistant organisms.
Exactly. You know, we've got 1,000 different species of microbes in our intestinal tract that live in a very complex ecosystem that needs to be balanced right. Otherwise, things go awry. And then we wind up getting sick, and we get all these problems with autoimmune disease and overgrowth of the wrong kinds of microbes and nutritional deficiencies and lots of symptoms. It's the same thing in the soil. The soil can be compared to the ecosystem of the planet as opposed to the ecosystem that we have in our gut. And when you throw things in there that are going to kill certain kinds of microbes, that's going to change the composition and the biochemistry of what and physiology of what's going on in the soil. We forget how important our soil is, because you can't make things out of nothing. And what's in the soil is going to determine what happens when a plant grows and what happens when we live on the Earth's surface and we're exposed to all that stuff. So we've got a huge problem.
Yeah,
here.
Now we're just like what's the problem in the hospital with all these antibiotic-resistant
infections. It's the same kind of
infections. We're getting insects that are resistant now to these insecticides, and the same thing, which I just said, I guess, about the weeds.
Well, the same thing happens with everything that we do. If we don't know what we're doing in terms of making changes, we shouldn't be doing it. We're doing a global experiment.
Well, it's huge money. It's big, big money. So well, there's a lot of conflict of interest between Monsanto and some of these other big companies and the FDA. And
well, what are some of the kinds of foods, Vicki, that are really...
Well, like in particular corn. This is what this particular study was, but corn...
That was what was done on the rats. And they only fed them 20-30% of their diet, that, by the way. It wasn't 100% of their diet.
So what people need to be aware of, when you're shopping for food, if there's not a sign that says non-GMO, non-genetically engineered, so it'll say non-GE or non-GMO, or... doesn't say that it's organic, you don't want to be buying some of these foods because they're loaded with these dangerous GMOs. Corn, soy, canola oil, sugar beets, cottonseed oil, zucchini, papaya, yellowneck squash. There's more on the list, but those are the main ones to be thinking about. So if you see those and they don't have the word organic in front of them, or there's not a sign that says non-GE or non-GMO, don't eat them.
It's the same kind of thing with organic food. You know, if something doesn't say this is organic food, you can kind of bet that it's not. And when something has a lot of ingredients in it, each one of them has to say organic in front of it, or it's not, or they're not organic.
And so what the other side, the conventional side, tries to say is, well, organic isn't all organic. Well, if it's not all organic, it's their fault, because there is something called a drift, you know. There's a little bit of wind or something that blows some of those seeds over there, or some of those pesticides over there, or cross-pollination. Well, some of that does happen. But organic is the best we can do right now.
Well, that's right. And we need to make some changes that are big-time changes that are going to make it.
And the way we vote is with our pocketbooks. You know, don't buy it. It's really crazy. I mean, there other countries are not allowing it, especially now since these studies.
Well, we have to do something ourselves. It's not going to be something that these big companies are going to take responsibility
for. Well, even their own cafeteria has a sign. One of their cafeterias, Monsanto, anyway, advising customers that they don't serve GM corn or soy in their restaurant.
Well, yeah, I mean, that tells you a little something. I mean, why are these companies in business in the first place? I mean, it's to make money. It's really not to do anything to help us in any particular way. I mean, if they can help us, that's great. They'd love to do that, because then we'll be buying it more. But if that's not the case, then they're going to wind up just doing what they can do to have a return on investment that makes sense for them.
So remember that Monsanto is doing their own short studies, and if their researchers admit that there's a problem, they fire them, their reputations are tarnished, the study results are absolutely ignored. They don't want anybody to know what the results of those. You know, an Australian study shows that if a pregnant mom ate genetically engineered wheat, her child would die before 5 years of age of liver failure. And now this wheat is not in the commercial food yet, but it's in the field trials, and it could easily be foisted on the public without proper safety trials, just like all the rest of it.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's time to wake up, America. You know, we've had enough of the business of what happens to our health when people who are interested in making money are in charge, because the conflict of interest is too much for them. We haven't evolved to a point where we're so concerned about what the planet's welfare is. We just do whatever we want to make more money. Well, and that's happening in every area of our culture. It's not just healthcare. It's business. It's law. It's medicine. It's religion. It's sport. It's all been commercialized. And it's that commercialization that's causing all these problems that are making things get out of hand. And it's why the planet is becoming polluted.
Well, think about it. If you put foreign genes in your body, there's going to be a reaction. And your body's going to go after them to attack them. You're going to get inflammation.
Well, that's right. You may even wind up with more allergies, more autoimmune conditions. We don't know the answer to a lot of that.
Well, there are a lot of people that think that it causes leaky gut syndrome.
Well, it's understandable how it might. I mean, you start messing around with how the genetic makeup of the food that you eat is different, the effect that it's going to have on our genes and the way our intestinal tract works can be huge. And if there's inflammation there, that's what can trigger the leaky gut syndrome, which is a very, very important illness that's underappreciated in Western medicine. It's all over the literature in the major journals, but for some reason, the gastroenterologists and the internists and the endocrinologists and the pediatricians are just looking past it as though it doesn't even exist. And it has so many complicated things. I'd like to refer you to drsaputo.com. Go to our website and put in leaky gut syndrome, and all this information will come up in audio and video that's short and right to the point that will give you an education about what leaky gut is all about. It's a huge issue in today's medical practice. And if you don't understand it and can't apply it, you just miss out. It's just that simple.
Also, you know, when you think about it, it's not just in the food. There's like a food chain, because the cows and the pigs and the other animals are fed this corn that's right. Genetically engineered, and so it ends up in the meat, and then we eat
DNA,
the meat,
and then we eat that. That's
and we
right.
eat that. So it's all over the place, and many people are saying that it's causing massive allergies and infertility and immunity problems and autoimmune problems and increases aging and messes with cholesterol and insulin and liver and kidney, spleen and the GI tract,
well,
everything.
Well, you'd have to be silly to think that it's not going to impact those things. And until you study it, you don't know for sure. And the problem is the human body is so complicated that we know just the very tip of the biochemistry and physiology of what's going on. Every nanosecond, there are hundreds of thousands of reactions that are occurring in a way that we hardly understand. If you look at a metabolic pathway chart that shows the biochemistry and physiology or the biochemistry of what's going on in the body, it's overwhelming just to learn the thousands of reactions from that chart. But to know how they interreact and what the electromagnetics are like and how the biophysics of it works and how the non-locality of it works, so we're looking at the quantum nature of what's going on there, this is complicated stuff. And yet we're still playing around trying to solve things in a way that is nonsense, because we don't even look at it. We don't have the capacity to look at it. And we probably never will, because we don't understand how a human cell works. And yet we're putting things in it so cavalierly that we don't worry about it. It's nonsense.
Well, I think that these GMO crops should be outlawed, and we shouldn't allow them. And the first step is to at least get them labeled so we know what we're buying. You know, if you'd like to join in our conversation, or you have any questions about our topics, or for your health, any questions about your health, you can give us a call on Mondays from 7 to 8 a.m. Pacific Time, or 10 to 11 Eastern Time on PRN.FM at 888-874-4888. That's 888-874-4888.
All right. It's just about time, Vicki, for your 2020 tip. So we're going to make that transition now. You're listening to Prescriptions for Health. I'm Dr. Len Sabuda here with Nurse Vicki. And again, like Vicki said, we're opening up the lines. The number is 888-874-4888. We'll be right back with more Prescriptions for Health Radio with Vicki's first tip, the truth about wheatgrass. And we'll be back talking about, can surgery actually bring on Alzheimer's disease?
Flavonoids and carotenoids, and it's a good source of protein and vitamins and minerals. A shot of it doesn't quite equal a typical serving of vegetables, so skip eating vegetables, because you know, it's important to have a variety of different foods to eat anyway. It's have a variable diet. So it's important to eat a balanced diet containing several servings of fruits and vegetables every day, but it's still a good idea to include some wheatgrass. One of the things that wheatgrass does is it supplies, better than your favorite veggie, is chlorophyll. I mean, it's the green pigment that's in the wheatgrass, and it's a powerful detoxifying agent, and it might even protect against abnormal cell growth, known as cancer.
Okay, going to start this over again because it looks like we had some transmission problems. So, okay, talking about your 20 tip wheatgrass, so go for it again.
Oh, well, it's good to have a variable diet. And I'm going to talk about some wheatgrass. You might want to consider adding that to your diet. It's sold in powders and pills, and it's good to make in a juice. And it's rich plant-based nutrients like flavonoids, carotenoids, and it's a good source of protein and vitamins and minerals. But one shot of it just doesn't quite equal a typical serving of vegetables. So you don't want to be eating your vegetables, because it is important to eat a balanced diet containing several servings of fruits and vegetables a day. One of the things that's so great about wheatgrass is that it contains a lot of chlorophyll. It's a powerful detoxifying agent. It might even protect against abnormal cell growth, which is known as the big CA, cancer.
Right.
It's a laboratory study, and it showed that wheatgrass even killed human leukemia cells, and another study in mice showed that you're less likely to develop skin cancer when wheatgrass is a part of diets. Different studies that indicated that it protects against DNA mutations, and the initial step in cancer development. So there's a lot of talk about that. In fact, I remember knowing somebody once that she used to give herself wheatgrass enemas. She had cancer, and she would drink it and give herself enemas with it. And they also found that wheatgrass reduced the toxicity of chemotherapy for breast cancer. And it boosts the levels of glutathione, which is the body's primary antioxidant. And the molecular structure of chlorophyll is found a lot in wheatgrass, and it's extremely similar to hemoglobin. So the reason wheatgrass juice might be helpful for anemia patients is because of this similarity.
Well, it may help some, but hemoglobin has iron and chlorophyll has magnesium. What's interesting about that is a lot of interesting studies were done on people who consume a lot of chlorophyll that you consume, the more you have protection against getting cancer. So it's really an interesting tip, Vicki.
I also found, we have a listener, a radio show listener, Barry Gourmet and Raw, and he has a lot of wheatgrass recipes. He teaches you how to grow your own wheatgrass, so you might want to check him out online.
Right.
Barry Gourmet and Raw.
I haven't really studied wheatgrass that much until you looked at this for your tip. Impressive good things about it, but keep in mind just one more thing, and we know what to do in a lot of ways to make sure that health is good. So thanks for that, Vicki. Well, you're listening to Prescriptions for Health. I'm Dr. Glenn Zabuti here with Nurse Vicki. The number is 888-874-4888.
Have you ever noticed that an older family or friend doesn't do as well following surgery? Well, clear up until this current it's from the anesthesia, the surgery itself, or the onset of Alzheimer's.
Yeah.
So we're going to talk about this current study at the University of Pennsylvania.
Yeah, this was published in September, this month's issue of 2012 in the Annals of Surgery. Basically, what they did is they looked at mice and they examined what happened to them at inhalation anesthesia in one group. And then in the second group, they gave them the inhalation anesthesia and a surgery to follow. And they all had genes that were predisposing them to develop Alzheimer's, so we knew that those particular mice were at risk for developing that and probably had some of the signs of it, but they yet weren't that obvious. And what they found was kind of surprising. It wasn't the anesthesia that caused the big problem. It was the surgery itself. So we know that anesthesia is a big problem because it's putting a drug into the body, plus any other drugs during the time you're getting the cast as well. So we thought, and I think most people agreed, that anesthesia was something that was dangerous for the brain.
Yeah, I think it's kind of a surprise.
It is, but you can see that it's even more dangerous to do the surgery. So what we have is new information. You know, we knew that when we did heart-lung bypass operations, the IQ of people after surgery was because something changed the way that they would be able to function. You actually lost brain cells. But thought that it was the anesthesia, but in this case, it was probably a combination of both. Operations we have, we need to be careful about what we're doing to our older people who are at risk for it, particularly.
Well, should be absolutely necessary in a last resort for the elderly, and especially if they have this vulnerability to dementia. But this is a big finding, and it does cause inflammation in the brain, I guess, when
yes,
you just
does.
Have surgery. But we know, too, on the side, I mean, you can't help but think that a person had an anesthesia, and if taking drugs after surgery and stuff, that some of that will affect your brain, too.
Well, it's both, but the surprise here is that the surgery has a much bigger effect than the anesthesia. So you're cutting into tissue and causing inflammation. That inflammation is spread all over the body, and it gets into the brain as well.
So what maybe we do is talk about some ideas that are elderly that might have this vulnerability to have dementia,
huh?
Maybe things that they can do before surgery if they have surgery.
That's a lot you can do to prepare yourself for surgery. And if you don't, you're just going to be at risk for all the things that happen. I mean, we have a whole list of things on the website that talk about what you do for Alzheimer's. What I suggest that you do for a real complete assessment of this is go to drsaputo.com. Put Alzheimer's in the search box. Back all these things that are dietary and in large part, but also related to exercise and other things.
I think we should mention, like, coconut oil. That's
yeah.
really important. So maybe to cook your meals with coconut oil.
All right, we're back. You're listening to Prescriptions for Health. I'm Dr. Len Saputo here with Nurse Vicki, and the number to call in to ask a question about your health is 888-874-4888. Had a little transmission problem there. We're talking about the cause of postoperative cognitive decline, meaning what happens to us when we go to surgery if we have a predisposition for developing Alzheimer's disease.
So if you're an elder person, it's better to probably put off the surgery or not do it unless it's necessary to do. I mean,
sure.
Some people have elective surgeries, and it might be something to think about.
Well, you're always taking a risk. You know, the people who have heart-lung bypass operations in particular, those are not so often elective, but they can be. If you can put that off, you should, because what's going to happen is you're going to be losing some brain cells every time you do that. And, of course, when we do just normal surgeries, what we found is that you have a problem with increased inflammation in the body from the surgery itself that leads to cognitive changes that are a problem. And Vicki and I were just talking about what can you do if you're older and you have to have a surgical procedure. What's the best thing to do?
So the first thing we mentioned was coconut oil, to cook with coconut oil.
Right. It's the medium-chain triglycerides that are in coconut oil that give the brain another source of energy besides sugar. Normally, glucose is what makes the brain work so well, but if we give it fats that are medium-chain triglycerides, it can make what are called ketone bodies, and the brain loves to use that for energy. And when you've got an electrical brownout basically occurring, because what happens in Alzheimer's disease is we can't make enough ATP, the energy currency of the cell, to keep them functioning right. So we provide it with another energy source, and we use this as a routine in our patients who have Alzheimer's, but it would also be smart to stock up on this for a couple of weeks prior to the time of surgery so that you can do something to reduce that that energy deficit. And then there are things like curcumin, a nice anti-inflammatory agent that's a fairly good anticoagulant as well, which is a good thing to have.
Plus it tastes good.
Yeah, it tastes real good. And niacinamide, another form of B vitamin, form of niacin. It's not niacin itself, it's niacinamide. And usually about 3 grams of that a day is a good idea.
And other things, too, like choline and B12, vitamin D, essential fatty acids, antioxidants, all those things are good to include in your diet if you want to try to prevent the progression of Alzheimer's or just to prevent it in the first place.
Well, it's a good way to protect. And then there are things besides diet. I mean, exercise is a really good thing to have done prior to the time that you have a surgery, because if you do exercise, it's going to help your body to be able to condition itself so that it can make more energy in an easier way when you're under stress.
And besides exercising your body, exercise your brain, too.
Exactly. So the mental exercises are huge, even if you do crossword puzzles. And then, of course, lastly, the social interaction. There has to be a lot of social activity to keep you interested in how life is going. So many people retire at 65, they get their gold watch, and they think they're going to go play golf for the rest of their life. And that's kind of a joke because, you know, we're not all going to be great golfers or spend our time thinking that's a wonderful way to do things. So that's the story on what you can do to prevent yourself from going downhill if you have any kind of predisposition for Alzheimer's disease. But even if you don't, you want to have your metabolism and physiology working ideally. So at the time that you go to surgery, you're in top shape and you can tolerate some of the inflammation that you're going to be exposed to.
You know, if you have any questions about your health or you want to join in our conversation, the phone number here is 888-874-4888. That's 888-874-4888. Well, the medical journal, The Lancet, out of England, shows that if you have a stressful job and you don't have the freedom to make decisions, your chances of experiencing a heart attack are 23% higher. Well, I guess we better think twice about job choices, huh?
Well,
it's not really that big of a surprise, but maybe that number is.
Well, you know that stress is not good for you. I mean, stress causes all kinds of problems. It makes your, from the biological and physiological and biochemical point of view, because what happens is you're making lots of hormones that have cortisol and adrenaline and noradrenaline in them, plus a lot of other hormones that react as a result of that. And that's going to cause changes in how your body operates.
Well, there was another study that found that women in high-stress jobs are 40% more likely to suffer from heart and other cardiovascular diseases like strokes and blocked arteries as well.
Well, it's something that you need to pay attention to if you can. But, you know, in today's world, it's not so easy to get a job, so we're trying to do what we can to do that. Now, the people that did this study in The Lancet in September 2012, that's this month, they looked at 200,000 people, and 30,000 of them had job stress, and about 2,300 over the next 7 years died. And so they figured there was about a 3.4% risk of having a complication like a heart attack. And they compared that to other things like smoking and exercise, and really pointed out quite fairly that, you know, smoking probably leads to about a 36% increase in heart attack rate, and lack of exercise to about 12% more heart attacks. So you've got something here that is still important, and every little bit counts. And, of course, who wants to live a life with stress anyway?
Well, they say 36%, but this other study found that women that I just said in high-stress jobs are 40% more likely to suffer from...
Well, that's what you see when you do different studies.
Yeah.
There's a lot of variation in how the study was done and a lot of conflicts that have to be worked through. One of the factors that's involved with this is lack of sleep. You know, if you have a lot of worry because of your job or you're angry, the stress that you see leads to insomnia. And insomnia itself leads to inflammation. And that inflammation, of course, causes changes in lots of the hormones in our bodies, like insulin, which we need to help protect against getting type 2 diabetes, and if there's too much of it around, because the insulin doesn't work so well. And that high level of insulin leads to lots of other problems. You're talking about things that are caused like hypertension or high triglycerides and cholesterol, and the tendency to convert sugar into fat, which makes us gain weight, especially around the middle with the kind of fat that's inflammatory itself.
It's like metabolic, we're talking metabolic syndrome here.
Exactly. And then there's another hormone called leptin that becomes resistant. And leptin is a very important hormone that's sneaking into the news more and more these days because it's a hormone that's made by our fat tissue that turns off our appetites. So when we eat, our fat tissue secretes leptin. Leptin goes to the brain and says you're not hungry anymore and you can push away from the table a lot more easily. But if that leptin has a resistance to it and it's not working as it should, then it doesn't have the same effect in suppressing appetite. So it leads to all the problems that we see that we have this huge epidemic that's leading to arteriosclerosis.
Well, the other thing that happens, too, is that when people are stressed, a lot of times they eat more.
Well, that's right, and this is one of the reasons why. So we're
also, they oftentimes turn to alcohol or drugs, and maybe they don't exercise as much as they should and get depressed. And a lot of people, you know, we already know that if you're stressed, it shoots your blood pressure up anyway, whether it's metabolic syndrome or not.
Well,
and then
right.
It can affect your family relationships, and a lot of people end up, you know, getting divorced or maybe abusive or what have you. So it's really important to think about your job choices, and if you have to take a job that's like this where you don't have the freedom to make decisions and there's a lot of stress, you need to work on things to do to help you with your stress.
Sure.
You don't want to come home and just vegetate.
You may do some exercising. You know, physical exercise is really good to work out stress. It's really good to work out depression, too. In fact, we know exercise works as well as antidepressants do. Just by doing an hour of hard exercise three times a week, you're going to increase your ability to get out of your depression.
And maybe using some essential oils, meditating, stretching, spending time with your friends, talking to a counselor. Even acupuncture can be helpful for things like that.
Exactly. All right, you're listening to Prescriptions for Health. I'm Dr. Len Sabuda here with Nurse Vicki. The lines are open at 888-874-4888. We'll be right back with more Prescriptions for Health Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. And we'll be talking about what types of jobs increase heart attack, and Vicki's final 2020 tip, the health benefits of sesame oil.
You might want to add some sesame oil to your diet, maybe some to your hair and your skin. And, of course, you want to use cold-pressed, organic, not processed sesame oil. And the sesame seeds, they're nutritive, they're preventative, they're curative, and they're rich in omega-6 fatty acids, and they contain antioxidants and vitamins and minerals and fiber, and they neutralize damage that's done by viruses and aging and bacteria. And sesame seeds are good for, we were just talking about drinking, they're good for hangovers because they can help the liver function by breaking down the alcohol consequence and detoxifying. Maybe if you're going to have a drink, it's good to have a few sesame seeds with it.
Good idea.
And then there's vitamin E and vitamin B that's found in sesame oil. That's good for the skin, and it's good for massage, and it helps infants to sleep better, too, if you massage that into your baby. And it helps in reducing some of the hurt and the swelling of rheumatoid arthritis, and it can also be rubbed on your scalp to prevent dandruff. Sesame seeds are beneficial in preventing tooth decay, bleeding gums, dry throat, and for strengthening the teeth, the gums, and the jaw. And in Ayurveda or Indian medicine, many times they recommend even gargling with sesame oil. It sounds kind of weird, doesn't it?
It does, but it works.
And even, you know, smelling a little sesame sesame oil helps to clear up the sinuses and congestion. And there was a study at Yale that showed that sesame oil lowers blood pressure, and it also lowers the sodium in the body. And it also contains calcium, which is good to prevent bone loss, and it's also good for headaches, and it lessens PMS symptoms, and it reduces stress. And so it also eases the fatigue and the insomnia that we were talking about earlier. And sesame seeds also contain phytates, and those are powerful antioxidants, and they're strong natural anti-cancer substances. And I was mentioning Ayurveda. There's something called Panchakarma.
Right.
And it's kind of interesting. I had it done a couple of times. They drizzle this warm sesame oil in the middle of your forehead. They call it your third eye.
Mm-hmm.
And this process is called Shirodhara. And it's supposed to cleanse the body and the mind with this warm, herbalized stream of sesame oil.
You know, it sounds kind of weird, but I'll tell you, this is a discipline that's been around for thousands of years. And there's a lot of people have been doing it for a long time, and I think history speaks a lot for the value of it. We ought to be including disciplines like this in the way we assess every illness that there is, because it's just another great approach. I love this stuff, Vicki.
They even recommend massaging the sesame oil on yourself before you take a shower.
Sure.
The only thing I could think about that, because of the beneficial effects, uh-huh. but I was thinking the other thing is, too, is it smells a little bit like peanuts.
Uh-huh.
Well, the sesame seeds, you know.
Yeah, well, that tastes good.
But I went and bought some sesame seeds after I was reading about this, and I plan to add them to my smoothies and my green drinks and sprinkle them in the salads and on top of entrees. I mean, you can use them for a lot of things, and
definitely.
They sound like they're pretty healthy.
A good idea for sure. All right, thanks for that, Vicki. The lines are open. You're listening to Prescriptions for Health. The number is 888-874-4888. So if you have a question, give us a call.
Well, it's that time of year again when we're encouraged to get the flu vaccine.
I can't believe how this is back in the press again. I thought this was a settled, done deal that this vaccine is a big mistake. It's
well, there's
a lot of
pressure for people to get them, and sometimes even the doctors will fire you if you don't go along with the program and get the vaccine. And now, in California, what are you thinking about this mandate for healthcare workers to get the flu vaccine or else they have to wear a mask for 5 months?
Well, this is nonsense. There are two counties in Northern California, one called Santa Clara County, and the other county I live in is Contra Costa County. And the hospitals are backing it up. And they're saying, if you don't take the flu shot, you're going to have to wear a mask, like Vicki was saying. And it's like, tell me where the data is. I sent information to the chiefs of medicine who were involved in the county that was making this decision, and of course never got an answer back, because the problem is these people simply don't know what the hell they're talking about.
Well, people
they haven't
need to
studied
know that,
it.
Yeah, people need to know that there have been no scientific studies. There's no double-blinded placebo-controlled studies, and yet they're telling us to get it every year, and it's loaded with neurotoxins and excitotoxins with the adjuvants and so forth.
Right.
And people just accept this. We just, like, follow the crowd, you
well,
know?
Well, the CDC says something, and we think, oh, that's sacred. We should follow it. And that's what the pediatricians are doing. And now it's what the hospitals are requiring. It's what the county is talking about. Everybody should be reading the article I wrote called The Infection Deception. It was published in one of the journals called The Townsend Letter for Doctors and Patients. And it's referenced with all kinds of appropriate mainstream literature that proves that these things are solid. Back in 2009, when this, quote, epidemic was brought into action, it was a joke. As you followed this, which I did with Vicki for about 9 months and published information about it almost daily.
It's on our website, drsaputo.com.
Right. It's the Infection Deception Part 1. It really goes over the details of what happened, and it's outrageous at the conflicts of interest. The CDC should be removed from America. They have so much baloney in what they present out there. As an example, this should clear up any doubt that you may have about that. CBS News was wondering back in the middle of or the late part of 2009 when the, quote, epidemic was at its height, was saying, well, how many cases of influenza and swine flu do we actually have in each of the states? So they sent a message to the CDC and said, can you share your information with us because we'd like to know? And they said, no, we aren't going to share the information with you. And then they sent a Freedom of Information Act request. They denied that, refused to give information. So CBS became suspicious of it, went out, did their own study. And what they did is they went to most of the states and said, how much do you have in the way of flu, of samples for flu testing for swine flu and for influenza, and how many of them came out positive? And to their surprise, say in the state of California, where Arnold Schwarzenegger, who was governor at that time, declared an emergency, there were 13,000 samples. You know what percentage was actually positive for influenza? 2%. Then they checked with a lot of other states, found the same thing. So what we have here is about a 90% overstatement that we actually have a problem at all with the swine flu at the time they're saying there's a pandemic.
Well, he said that there was up to 98% of the cases of H1N1 were colds or other types of upper respiratory viruses,
right,
or bacteria. They weren't even the H1N1 flu anyway.
And there weren't that many cases. There were probably, in my estimate, at following this carefully, maybe around 1,600 to 2,000 deaths, okay, from the flu in the whole United States. You know, and every year they say there are 36,000 deaths from the flu, even though I'll have to say they later came out within about the next 6 months saying that that number wasn't right. Well, it's about time that they acknowledge that.
Because when they were claiming it was a pandemic, they included other things too, like pneumonia and all types of flu, and they, in fact, they stopped counting.
Well, they told us to stop counting. I mean, the CDC told us there's no point making any more counts because we know that this is a very popular thing. The White House Office of Science and Technology estimated that 30 to 50% of the country would wind up infected with the virus, 2 million people would be hospitalized, and 30 to 90,000 people would die. Well, what the hell? It never happened. Of course it didn't happen. Why would it?
And now what's kind of scary is that a lot of the research from Canada and Hong Kong finds that the flu vaccine increases the risk of H1N1 double. It doubles the risk of getting it by getting a flu shot. And that's any kind of a flu shot, the seasonal flu shot or the H1N1 flu shot. Listen, I would never get one of those shots. Plus, they still have thimerosal and aluminum, which are neurotoxins. And
well, the fact is they don't work either, Vicki. I mean,
they
that's
decrease
the big thing.
Immunity, actually.
Well, when you they can, that's right. And who would benefit from immunization anyway? It's the people who are immunocompromised, who can't respond to a vaccine very well. Who responds to it? The people that don't need it, the people that have strong immune systems. So what are we doing here? You talk
to somebody. Safe. It's better to get the flu anyway. You get more immunity if you get it naturally than if you get this artificial vaccine.
Well, talk to Tom Jefferson, okay, who is in charge of vaccine in the Cochrane Collaboration, which is a very sophisticated and well-respected organization that looks at this. And his comments are that we really don't look at, we don't have any science in immunizations for almost any of them. And what we should be doing is outcome studies where we look at one community that's getting a vaccine and another community that doesn't get a vaccine, and then look at the thing scientifically. How many people did well because they didn't get the illness? How many people had side effects to the vaccine?
But they don't
not a complicated study.
They don't want to do this. It's not science. It's political power.
Well, that's right.
And then the vaccine companies were granted immunity. They're protected by the government. They're not liable. There's no incentive there for safety. Congress gave them $7 billion.
In advance of the sales. Tell me there wasn't a conspiracy here. It's hard to figure out. And then you look at what happened with the definition of a pandemic. It was conveniently changed about a month before at the World Health Organization level to have a different meaning. It wasn't like the Spanish flu in 1918 where millions of people died. They changed it to have nothing to do with morbidity or mortality. All it is tracking any illness that there is from one country to another country to another and then calling it a pandemic, which means everybody's getting it. But what if you're talking about a simple cold, which is what this was? I mean, that's outrageous.
Well, it was kind of an excuse so the government would fund the vaccines, too.
Well, that's what it's turned out to be. And now the CDC comes out again and says, take your flu shot. Go down to Walgreens or go down to Walmart and get your free flu shot. Hello? How many people have gone over this thing like we have and presented the facts? You know, Gary Null did that Gary did a great job. So did Jim Turner. These people, when New York City came out and made statements about you had to take the flu vaccine, they went to work and proved with some of the arguments that we're using that that was bunk. And what happened as a result? It got overturned, and there was an injunction put on it, so that could never happen anymore. And who are the people involved? Again, it's the CDC. You know who Julie Gerberding is? She was the director of the CDC at the time all this was happening, before Obama was elected. Where does Julie Gerberding work now? Merck. And what does she do? She's in charge of their vaccine department. And if she's making what other people make in the same position with other companies, she's making a couple of $1 million a year, and she's getting stock options in return. Now, that may be good business, but I hate to read her epitaph.
People are just have been brainwashed about this, and I know it's difficult to change your mind about things and to stand up to the doctors when they're being so domineering and arrogant and insisting that you get vaccinated and that also that you vaccinate your children. Parents are often considered heretics if they refuse to vaccinate their kids. But we need to think about things we can do to prevent the flu that are natural and things we can do if we do get it. And what happened the last time when they claimed that there was this pandemic was they got on people that sold nutraceuticals or gave healthy advice to people, and they were trying to put them out of business.
Well, that's right.
What?
Well, that's where you're right.
Yeah, they were trying to put them out of business. They tried to do that with Dr. Andrew Weil because he was recommending astragalus. But everybody should know that it is healthy to have enough vitamin D and vitamin C, reduce your sugar intake, maybe some herbs.
Looks like we're just finishing up with the topic of this business with the swine flu and all the corruption that goes with it. And we really need to take a stand here that's hard, because this is something that's one of the most criminal things that I've seen. And, of course, our own Gary Null is the one who's leading the way here. So it's really a bizarre thing that we've fallen for it now several years in a row. It's time to put a stop on that. And we promised we were going to talk about one other topic that had to do with the breath. You know, we talk about garlic breath, and we know that's not so good. We talk about baby's breath, which is a wonderful sweet smell that we have. We know that there are
that
different
we
kinds.
Have.
Well, when we're babies. And there's also different kinds of breath that people have with different kinds of illnesses. I know that people with diabetes have a different breath. When I was an intern and a resident and I was training, we could walk into a room and almost make a diagnosis from the smell in there. And now we have this business that's talking about lung cancer breath. What does that mean? So we're looking.
The sniffer dogs know what it means.
Indeed. You know, what Vicki's talking about here is that there are dogs that are trained to be able to tell if someone has breast cancer. In fact, we met the person who did the study, because he's from Northern California as well, and met the dogs, and it's amazing at how accurate this can be. And it's not really a surprise, because what we're talking about is there volatile chemicals that are exhaled in the breath that are put out by cancer cells but not any other cells? And the answer is absolutely. So what we found in this study that was done, that was published, was that there is a lot that you can do to identify these compounds by doing gas chromatography and mass spectroscopy, which are ways of looking at what's in the breath itself. And when you can do that, it's a lot easier than doing what we normally do. I mean, who wants to do a biopsy and a bronchoscopy or an open lung biopsy to have to try to find out if there's something that's negative or positive?
And then the CT scans have a 96% false positive rate with, you know, when they're looking for lung cancer.
Right. So we're overdoing a lot of this. And of course, the costs go up and the morbidity goes up. And we got lots of problems here that need to be paid attention to.
And it's also interesting to note that a lot of lung cancer nodules clear up on their own.
Well, a lot of the cancers clear up on their own, too. You're talking about that in breast cancer as well. If you did autopsies on women that are 50 years old who died from things other than cancer, you'll find that about 30% of them have invasive cancers. But why don't 30% of women who are 50 years old come down with cancer and have a morbidity and mortality from it? It's because these cancers go away on their own. So we've got lots of problems here to work out. And looking at spectroscopy, to look at the breath and see what comes out there in the breath could be a big improvement. We could do the same thing by checking urine to see what's in it, or checking sweat to see what's in it as well.
And, you know, doing this test with the breath would also cost less and be a lot easier on the patient, too, and you wouldn't have all this extra follow-up that might not be necessary or that leads to other tests.
Well, it's a good way to go, but we're at the close of the show, and I'd like to remind you that we'll be back to talk about what's new in the news and health and take your health questions every Monday morning on PRN.FM and drsabuto.com from 10 to 11 Eastern Time and 7 to 8 Pacific Time. Prescriptions for Health will also be available 24-7 on drsabuto.com as well as PRN.FM.
And if you enjoyed today's show and you'd like to have more information on the topics that we discussed, go to Dr. Saputo Radio on drsaputo.com and check out our Fast Track videos. And remember, lifestyle is the most powerful healer in the universe. So if you want to be well, pay attention to the style in which you live your life.
Have a great week. We'll see you next week.